All right, so here we are on the Most High Show. My name is Christian. Joining me today, of course, is David.
You.
Jock Cleope. Leslie is on the ones and twos.
And she's doing a great job over there. It's like you've been working there for a long time or something.
Yeah, she's really good on the fader.
Yeah.
Yeah, she knows when to cut, when to slice. And today, we have a friend of ours, Dr. Weston Robbins.
Welcome.
He's in the building. And we're going to be talking about the mental health field in general, but also radical youth work, what that is. Mm-hmm. And we'll see what happens. He sent me a list. He goes, here's a brief summary of what
I think, dude. Is that what you sent
us?
And
it's like 18 bullet points with like 30 syllables.
Stress. In,
but I wanted to give like a lot.
No, it's great.
No, that's awesome. We're just bullshitting.
We just mess with you.
It seemed pretentious.
Huh?
It seemed pretentious.
No, you're a very brilliant man.
And yeah, so, we're just trying to keep up with you, bro.
Do I need to pretend like this is just audio, like it's radio?
No,
okay. Man. You can move around.
Like, is anybody just listening to it?
You know, someone will be at some point. Yeah,
it will be.
Because I'm awful at that. What? Like, if you don't have the visual with the audio, I'm not good. Like, I'll go for
what do you do? Like a bunch of body expressions?
Just not say anything. Yeah. Or like reference stuff that like, and be like, you know, like he was like, and act it out. And people like, if you were listening back to it, it makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah. And then he went like this.
See this. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You
remember that part when he went like that?
Yeah. Don't worry about that.
Okay. No, it's all good, man.
So, I feel like that intro was weak compared to what we're really going to dive into.
And no, this is going to be awesome.
I'm going to tell you why this topic is very interesting to me. And it started when we had a guest on, Charlie Shaw.
Shout out.
Who does holistic healing using plant-based medicine. Mm-hmm. So primarily like psychedelics, ibogaine.
Psilocybin.
And tryptamine. I had a pre-interview with him, which we talked, right? Because he reached out to me and he was kind of like... He kind of offended me in the reaching out to be on the show. And so I was like, all right, I wasn't offensive, but it was kind of like, you know, this 12-step stuff you're talking about is bullshit and la, la, la. And so I was like, well, I'd love to talk to you because that sounds like an interesting conversation. And during our conversation, it was the pre-interview, it began to open up something that I've already been kind of thinking about, right? And so that led me to books. He recommended a book. I read that book. I've been reading other books. And then it led me to this fentanyl stuff and how the fentanyl is getting in here and listening to authors who have been studying this kind of stuff for a long, long time. And so then it started like piecing these pieces together. And so at the same time, I started doing coaching in IOPs, right? Mm-hmm. And there was an interesting thing that I was witnessing as I was being a part of it, right? There's kind of a game and an industry to it, just like anything. Same sense that I had when I worked at a church, right?
Yeah, because when you see that reveal, that's a serious reveal because you have this depiction of church and God and all this stuff, and then you see numbers and business and desks and computers and budgets and whoa.
Yeah. So all of that has kind of got me thinking about how this whole industry and how everything I think is beginning to shift. And I think like the psychedelics healing and the holistic way of treating and seeing people in the whole self, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that some of the stuff that we're going to get into. So the first thing I want to ask Wes is I want to talk about this thing called radical youth work. When I met you, I thought you made that up.
You didn't make it up?
I'm busted.
Wait a minute.
But
you didn't make that shit up?
It's part of a larger...
I'm gonna head out.
It's part of a larger thing, right?
Yes, absolutely. So the first time the term itself has been researched and written about theoretically by Dr. Hans Scott Meyer, who is a tenured professor at Kennesaw State University in the Child and Youth Services Department.
Oh, wow. Close.
Yep.
Okay.
And he's also been at University of West Georgia. And then his wife, Dr. Kathleen Scott Meyer, who's at University of West Georgia, and she's written on critical psychology and autoethnography. And she's brilliant. And so they were my dissertation committee, and they've written extensively about radical youth work. So as I opened the center, it was really, you know, it was interesting because it felt synchronistic in a lot of ways. I didn't look to Hans or Kathy to do a tremendous amount in my PhD on youth work. I was already doing so much therapeutically with my licensure, and then I opened the center, and I was just trying to finish my PhD, which was on addiction. Addiction as a whole, not just with youth, but my own lived experience, addiction from a biological, psychological, sociocultural, developmental, spiritual, like looking at all these lenses. But then as I built the center, I focused on utilizing humanistic and person-centered counseling, which is what I'd done for years in private practice.
Right.
And then as I did more and more and I brought in the experiential, I started to lean back again on Hans and Kathy. And I was like, man, that's right. Hans wrote that book called Youth Subculture as Creative Life Force. Let me go read that again. And so in the earliest seeds of building the center, I was simultaneously reading these theories and what is radical youth work.
Okay.
And that's where I had them out to the center, and they were like, oh my God, you've taken our theory.
Right.
Some places have used little bits and pieces of,
right,
but you're the first place that we've seen integrate all of it.
Their words come to life.
Doing radical youth work.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to integrate it more and more, and I asked them. And they said, you know, they said, we would love for you to finish your doctoral degree and then be able to have you write a book with us called Radical Youth Work.
Huh.
And they were like, but we're not going to talk to you about it anymore until you finish the PhD. And I was and so I was like, but then I want to turn it into a methodology. And do I have y'all's blessing to do that? And they were like, absolutely. But finish the dissertation.
Get your degree.
Yeah.
So if you go Google Radical Youth Work, you will see Dr. Hans Scott Meyer and Dr. Kathy Scott Meyer and all the beautiful articles that they've written, the research that they've done, different podcasts that they've been on.
And I listened to one of them. But before we go further with that, I just want to break down, because you mentioned this biopsychosocial model, right? Which is the biological component of a human, the psychological component of the human, the social component of being a human, and then also spiritual, right? And so would I be wrong in saying that addiction is primarily the main, or at least up to this point, has been the main, let's say disease, just for lack of a better word, that medicine or clinicians or the industry has approached in that holistic way? Or do you think, is there other things that are being approached with that same biopsychosocial spiritual component to healing, all those components together?
Right. One, I want to address what you said about addiction as a disease. And I know that I've talked recently a lot about like words and how important they are and labels. But I think what's really important is framework for the individual. So when people say to me who have been in 12-step and AA and NA, look, addiction's a disease. I'm not trying to get in a heady fucking argument about whether it is or not.
And because it's such a,
and
man.
And it's beautiful if it served them in their understanding of what a disease is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go back to the earliest writings between, who were the two AA guys? There was
Billy Bill.
Bill and Dr. Bob.
So maybe it was a letter between Carl Jung and Dr. Bob.
It's Carl Jung wrote a letter to Bill about one of their guys that I think it was Ebby who was spent like 3 months with Carl Jung and then got on the train to go home and drank on the train and then went back. And so then Carl Jung wrote this letter.
And he wrote a beautiful letter that was mainly about, look, this is a spiritual ailment. And
which he couldn't
get aligned spiritually.
Yes.
You can approach this from every angle that you want to, but this is a spiritual thirst and an attempt to commune with God.
Yeah. He couldn't use those words because of his standing. And he even says this in the letter is brilliant. So if anyone listening, just look up Carl Jung letter to Bill W.
It almost feels like folklore when we talk about it.
But you can read the actual letter. Yeah. And when he wrote that, he even says a power greater than himself or outside.
Yeah.
Because he has to be so particular about his language.
Yeah.
Because of the industry.
Not the letter I was referring. There's that letter, but
there's another one.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Oh, really?
And I think it's either Dr. Bob or Bill W, or maybe it's Bill W writing to Dr. Bob and saying, is addiction really a disease? And I think it's Dr. Bob that writes back and goes, we have to use the term disease to convey the hopelessness, to convey the severity. So he really starts to play with semantics in the wording where he's going, let's not get hung up on whether it's an actual disease, but it is important to use this term because it mimics a disease and it's killing so many people and it's so severe. So just...
Yeah, and the benefit of them identifying it as... I'm not aware of that other letter, but I'd like to look that up too. But the benefit of them calling it a disease in the 20s was it took the moralistic nature from the behavior away.
1,000%. And it wasn't a moral failing. It wasn't a judgment. It wasn't a looking down upon the individual as it's a character fault.
Right? Yeah,
this is a victim of a disease, somebody that is struggling that needs treatment.
Instead of a loser.
Yes.
Oh, he's a hobo.
But a lot of people still have that. I don't think you will ever break totally free from that stigma because some people just don't understand what it's like to struggle.
And to come back to your initial question, where is addiction the primary arena where biopsychosocial holistic lens is being utilized? I'd say no. I'd say it's the biopsychosocial model developed, I think, in the late 80s, maybe mid 80s, and I can't remember who developed it, but it's being used throughout. And so eating disorders,
it's the assessment process.
Right. Yeah. And that lens has been very helpful and useful in looking at a tremendous amount of stuff.
I think what's rare about that is adding the spiritual and holistic side to it. That's not common practice. You know what I mean? That's, there's not a lot of medical fields as they're assessing you going to ask you about your spiritual life or try to assess your spiritual groundedness or where you are at with a higher power or whatever
people,
that is.
People convey, David, they think like you either have it or you don't.
Yeah.
Everybody's got a spiritual. Whether you want to admit it.
Talking about
you're
words.
You're living in relationship to spirit realm and spirit world and your soul and your spirit. Even if you are atheist, agnostic, completely secular.
Yeah.
You're in the spirit world, man.
Well, see, that's the thing. It's the same thing with like that word disease. The word spiritual connotates, I guess, is the thing. Yeah. A certain thing.
It's actually pronounced. No, just
it congregates and coapulates.
Yeah.
I love to use
keep
words
talking that stuff.
Aren't real words. I've been using frequently irregardless.
Ooh.
And I just read that it's one of the 14 words shouldn't use. Irregardless isn't a word. And then concretize. Ooh.
That's good.
It's not a word.
Oh.
I learned that and then I like beatific.
Oh.
These aren't words.
My wife is an expert.
Words. We created words. So
Keith Murray got his own whole dictionary.
Fantabulous.
Yeah.
Fantastic and fabulous.
Dopealicious.
Yeah.
Ooh. Dope-alicious.
I like that. But when the word spiritual is brought up, it creates kind of this thing.
Yes.
And the way I like to say what spiritual means is it's the intangible. Mm. It's the thing you can't really put your finger on.
Yeah.
Something about that night was magical, spiritual. There was something about when Wes and I first connected that was intangible. There was spirit there.
Yeah.
Right?
So, and cannot be described by language. You can attempt, you can get close to it, poetry, music.
Metaphor.
But the
it never lives up to it.
Right.
Words never live up to the experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a limited. I was thinking about the field of phenomenology, which is just lived experience.
You made that word up. Don't play around. You know you do.
But they talk about
David is counting all of the seven syllable words you used tonight.
Here we go. Get ready. Buckle up. I remember getting into the doctoral program, and I remember like the first few classes just feeling super insecure and inadequate and being like, I pulled the dissertation, the program directors aside, Dr. Neil Korobov, and I was like, man, I don't know if I'm cut out for this. Mm. And he had to really kind of walk me through letting, because there's a lot of pretentiousness and there's a lot of people that don't want to take time to explain things to you.
Right.
But phenomenology, the field, is lived experience. And so if you were going to study, like a good example would be like if you were going to study an orange, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could measure it, you could weigh it, you could look at its molecular makeup, you could, it as a chemical compound, the field of phenomenology would want you to the best of your ability, describe your lived experience of eating that orange.
Mm. Ooh.
Intangible.
Yeah.
The thing that only you
are experiencing.
And it's, you're trying to convey that.
I like that.
There was this brilliant psychologist, Jacques Lacan, Lacanian psychotherapy, and he has a concept called the real. And he would say the same thing. The real, and we experience it at different times, is this intangible, you're unable to utilize any of the things that we have in the material realm to describe it because it's so effervescent and
beyond. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So the, I'm just trying to keep us on track because we'll go.
I love this too.
So.
Love this.
This biopsychosocial spiritual model has been used in other forms of practice in healing of people, but it's been primarily in mental health or emotional health fields.
Yes. And it's still my frustration is that all of these fields in Western medicine, we're still very specialized.
Right.
So like a good example is like if you go to an endocrinologist or an immunologist or a neurologist, you're not getting a lot of overlap in those clinical professionals speaking to one another.
Right.
Right.
And another cool field that I really like, and this happened a lot in oncology and cancer research, was PNI, psychoneuroimmunology. Which was the relationship between your psyche,
mm-hmm.
your immune system, and your neurology, and watching all of that. So like literally your thoughts and your cognitions and how they're impacting your immune
system. How they're affected,
And your neurochemical firing and growth. So when you say biopsychosocial, it's a great general way.
Yeah.
To look at a human being and go, whoa, 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 there's no way to pull them apart. So all the medical professionals that just want to measure the biological and the biochemical and the neurological, you have to take into account for the social, the cultural, the environmental, and the psychological, and they all impact one another all the time, and where they overlap is pretty much mental health, if we want to use that term.
Mm. Right.
And so let's look at all of those arenas. Let's look at the biochemical, the genetic, and let's look at the psychological and your cognitions, and let's look at the environmental.
Yeah.
And the example I always like to give is if you take a young child who maybe has a genetic challenge like trisomy 21, which is known as Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
They are always going to have that genetic, biological predisposition DNA.
Right.
No matter what, they're going to have that. But that individual's social environment, family system, and psychologically what they think about themselves, cognition and emotion is going
to have a tremendous
impact on how they live their best life.
Right.
And then you can go the other route and you can say, all right, give me a kid that is completely neurotypical and has no genetic challenges or deficits,
right,
and put them in a Russian orphanage from the time they are born until they're 3 years old. And I guarantee you, from environmental abuse,
neglect,
severe mistreatment of that child, their biochemistry and neurology is going to develop completely different.
Yeah. Just without a doubt.
Social environment. Right. So it's like, the only way you could do real experiments on it, you'd have to be like, give me 150 babies. And then you'd have to like run all these weird experiments where you isolate the environments and you just look at this. Right. So,
but we don't need to do that, because as you're explaining this and as others have explained this, it's easy to go, this is true, what you're explaining, right? The example I use always is, if I bake a cake and I put eggs and sugar and milk and flour, and I whip it all up and I put it in the oven and I bake it and it rises, and then I give it to you and I tell you, here's the cake, but I only want you to eat the egg.
Yes.
You great can't example. Eat the egg.
Yeah.
Because it's all one, right? Right. And your approach in this radical youth work is kind of, that's how you're approaching the human. You're approaching the whole person as seeing them as one and not isolating these. The other example is that I went to an addictionologist maybe 5 years ago, and that was the first time that I had somebody who checked my hormones, checked my vitamins, did a brain scan, had a psych evaluation, right? Talked about God, all that. And I had that in one, you know, in one place. And that was the first time I'd ever experienced that. And I really wish that everybody would have that opportunity. There's just not a lot of...
Well, it's just like you said, everybody stays in their lane.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's hard to do, because for an addictionologist, they have to stay up on their medicine licensure, their psychological licensure,
yeah,
all of that stuff, right? It's a very difficult practice to... all right. So do you think you've explained kind of what... I feel like maybe there's some more that you can explain about. Let's like break it down to how would radical youth work be different than sending your child to a really good counselor?
Yeah. And this is very, very important for me to articulate well. So at the heart of radical youth work, what we just talked about, biopsychosocial, mm-hmm, it's beautiful. It's great. I would put that more in the arena of humanistic and person-centered counseling and psychotherapy.
Okay.
So the really good Rogerian person-centered,
yeah, humanistic, I think he came up with that,
counselors,
yeah,
they're rocking biopsychosocial, right, all day long. They're,
yeah,
looking at the holistic person, biologically, psychologically, socioculturally, spiritually. Radical youth work, I think I'm 30% of the way there. The way that we are doing it is a combination of experiential work with these young people, community engagement, mm-hmm, and empowering them to build and create community, tribal connection, and then the humanistic counseling and psychotherapy. But at the heart of radical youth work is really recognizing youth as not separate from adults, recognizing this is a socioculturally constructed division, mm-hmm, that isn't necessarily true. So it's how youth workers are with youth is very important. And so two of the tenets of radical youth work would be mutual liberation. The youth worker and the youth working in conjunction with one another.
Like side by side instead of like top down.
1,000%.
Right, yeah.
And then really empowering the youth to have autonomy, to listen to them, mm-hmm, to have a voice, and then a flattening of that hierarchy.
Yeah.
Because that's what you see all the time. In any youth work, you traditionally see a guide, an adult that is telling the youth what they need to do,
yeah,
or teaching the, right, youth, or approaching it from a standpoint of, I am an expert and I am going to help you and I know how to help you.
Yeah.
Our radical youth work is, I want to know who you are as a human soul, and I'm going to show you who I am as a human soul, and then we can join together and hopefully we can tune into our creative potential with one another and offer one another something as we walk this road together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I dig that. I dig that. I dig how that comes off, because one of the biggest things that I've noticed is that if I openly like say, like if a teenager's talking to me and he has shown me something, you know what I mean? Or I've learned something from him.
Yeah.
And I said, man, I didn't even know that. And we start discussing the brightness.
Oh, yeah.
Behind that.
Yeah.
It's like so like, it's like opening. Now that person's opened up to tell you everything that he or she knows. You know
Absolutely.
What I mean? So that's good. That's and that's connection. You can't do that. Because if you have that, if you're top looking down, you have to have like, there's a pride behind that that keeps you from admitting, oh man, you taught me something. Absolutely. I never knew that.
Yeah.
Now, that's amazing.
Is that what, because I listened to an excerpt of the podcast you sent me in preparation of this from the Dr. Hans.
Yep, Hans Scottmeyer.
And there was just a short little piece and I kind of caught it. That this youth work, right? And then we then go into a world system that is hierarchical, right? And tell me if I'm wrong. I'm aware I read this into the interview, but it seemed like they're saying that like this radical youth work is not as supported because it's not creating. I'm just going to. We didn't want to go conspiracy, but it doesn't create the robotic individuals.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right? It creates free thinkers. It creates people who, because if you're a kid that kind of grows up being validated and understood and you're understanding the world and the limitations that others place on you, you're like, what am I doing with that? Right?
Yeah.
Like, is that, was I reading into that or is that what you kind of talk about in
that's
the cultural?
The radical youth work is not concerned with behavioral conditioning and trying to make a child fit into the world and function a particular way. Radical youth work is at the heart of allowing that kid to have a voice and go on the journey that they need to. Now, I don't want to say torn, but I do a delicate dance between being a guide and a psychotherapist and a radical youth worker. And so how do you walk that line where you can give a kid absolute autonomy and freedom to be who they want and to go on the journey that they need to, and at the same time be yourself and try and encourage them to make healthy decisions.
Yeah, now that's
let
the
go
right
of whether they do or not.
You got to hope
because parents want to go make my kid do this.
Yeah.
So then I can calm down. Control.
His daddy was a lawyer. His grandfather was a lawyer. Bobby wants to be a lawyer. He just doesn't know it yet.
Yeah.
Wes, please help us.
Yes.
Help me and the wife.
Right. But Christian, I mean, you said it great where it's like, I like Hans when he really goes in depth and he speaks about the social construction of the category of adolescence and how that even came into being, how it got defined, and then all the ways that we define youth and the narratives that we put around what it means to traditional psychological development and growth. So developmental psychology has these kind of presuppositions of from the time you are 10 until you're 25, you're going through these different stages of growth. You have executive functioning. Your frontal lobe isn't fully formed. Mm-hmm. There's all these things that are very concrete that almost speak down to youth. And it's hurry up and grow up.
Yeah.
And then, but I look around and I'm like, why are we hurrying up to grow up?
Right.
And how many adults feel like they've achieved something and they can teach youth? Meanwhile, they're struggling, they're miserable, they're not caring for themselves. So what do the youth have to teach us? And how can we listen to them and do that in conjunction? Because youth is really an energy. And I would say that becoming child and creative life force, we all have that youth within us.
Oh my goodness, you remember his baby picture and his adult picture? It's the same. That is it right there. That's that should be the picture.
I sent them a picture of me as a baby and me as adult, and I look
pull
basically
it up, Leslie. Pull up the pic, Leslie.
You guys got to see this to believe
it. This is why I say to you, Wes, that I feel like I get what you're doing, because there's a local high school that wanted me to do something on vaping.
Yeah.
And Leslie is a huge advocate trying to get me in there, and I'm like, yeah, but I can't go in there and tell them don't do this.
Yeah.
Because the one thing, like, if you want to get someone to do something, tell them don't do it.
My team got really mad because I was like, what about we do like Eternal Strength vapes?
Oh,
and they were like, no.
Maybe not.
But it is. It's like you're absolutely right. Where as soon as you start to try and control or act like you're invested in wanting to change behavior. Mm-hmm. It's like, man, that young person's going to dig in even more to prove their autonomy and their independence.
Yeah.
So you got to start from a premise of, look, you have ultimate free will. Each one of us does. Each one of us has ultimate free will. Nobody can control you. So let me get that. Let's just name that out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then let me tell you about who I am. You can tell me about who you are, and I'll carve a sacred space with you. And I'll always give you my truth. I'll tell you if I feel like you're making unhealthy decisions, but I'll do it in a way where I go,
right,
you have the right to go do that.
To that point, this kind of work is not negating cause and effect.
Never.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, and especially with the way fentanyl is in so many drugs, you know, the days of casual experimental drug use are very dangerous now. Right.
Yes.
So it is like cause and effect. Yeah. You take a pill at a party as a 16-year-old in 2013, there's a significantly high percentage probability that you're going to have fentanyl in it. Mm-hmm. If it's a pill that's been purchased on the street.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. And so this youth work is not negating that, hey, there's cause and effect. You drive drunk, you can get a DUI or you can kill somebody. And there is going to be cause and effect in your life. But I guess in the seeing the person as a whole and allowing them to be that, maybe there's an innate thing within each of us that wants to participate in the greater good of, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's about how youth hear it. And so, I mean, I can remember I was maybe like 18, 19, and I was using methamphetamine. And there was this kid that I ran into, and he was 16. He'd been making it. And I was like, oh, man, will you front me some? And he was like, yeah, I will. And I went up. I went to his house, and I went up to his bedroom, and he pulled me to the side, and he said, look, man, I'll give you this, but I want to let you know how damaging it is and what it's doing to your body and your brain. And he pulled out a textbook that had all this stuff on meth.
The moral drug dealer.
Yeah. And he started to break down. He showed me pictures of brain scans and everything. And the whole time I was like, give me the fucking meth, dude. What are we doing? So I go back into where I was.
Yeah.
And the people that I listened to and the people that I completely tuned out. And anybody that came at me with fear and education from a standpoint of
talking down.
Hey, kid.
Trying to school you.
Hey, if you get behind, you drink and drive, this is going to happen. Or if you do this, this is going to happen. So how can we creatively carve a space with a young person to let them see our true hearts? And then you let go of, you know, you just want to go, I want to give you as much education as I can, but I also want to know what you know and what you understand. So I have these beautiful and brilliant processes with clients about psychedelics, their use, different substances, and then you absolutely want to give good psychoeducation, but in a way that isn't fear-mongering and isn't showing that you're just like, you're not going to leave my office and do this, are you?
Right.
It's more like,
it isn't like the egg into the frying pan. This is this is drugs.
Yeah.
This is your brain on drugs. Get it?
Because it's the person.
All that made me want it was eggs.
But it's the person in your life that you're going to come back to and go, I know I can go tell so-and-so because they're not going to immediately judge me or panic or freak out. I can go holler at this person because I know they'll listen and I can really bring my truth to them.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I'm watching happen with youth and mental health. They already know, man. They're not going to tell you. They're not going to tell you unless you're really safe.
Yeah.
Unless they can really trust that they can process it with you and you're not going to immediately break confidentiality.
Absolutely.
Or jump into, you know, every single time you come in for a session, they're going to be like, have you used?
Yeah.
Have you used since last weekend? It's like, it just seems inauthentic and it seems like the clinician has an
agenda. That's a bad move.
Yeah. Well, and I know people and we've had people on the show who had, you know, behavioral issues young and drug use young, and they, you know, talked about how those youth programs didn't work. how it made them rebel even more, and how they couldn't be honest with their counselor because they knew that if they talked about hurting themselves or suicidality, yeah, that it would get escalated. And so kids would sit in those rooms and just play the role,
yeah,
play the game, and wouldn't get the healing until much later.
Yeah.
So Richard Rohr talks about this thing called a container. And it's in this book called Falling Upwards. And he talks. Yeah.
I read it. I gave it to somebody else. We read it together.
Oh, awesome. Mm-hmm. So he talks about this container, right? Like that there's a container that's kind of before. And again, this is just language and kind of frameworks for us to try to understand all these things. And he says that there's a second container that gets kind of built. And that's the, and we could say that's maybe the ego or the character, the person, right? It's mm-hmm. those lived experiences kind of compounded. And somebody can kind of get into that second phase of life very young, is what he says in the book. It has nothing to do with age, mm. right? And if a kid goes through a traumatic experience at home or witnesses something or sees something, or for whatever reason, that they can somehow get into that second phase of life very quickly and very young. And do you think that, is that what allows you when you're sitting there kind of co-creating this person's present and possible future, do you think it's because they have some sort of pain or experience that they're drawing from that allows them to kind of explore that? I mean, kids aren't coming to you that are fully, you know, I mean, there's something going on in their life, right? And some reason for it.
I would say there's a lot of kids. I would say every single young person wants a tribe, wants connection, and is ready for a deeper space mm-hmm. and process. And so we're seeing kids from every spectrum. And so it could be severe challenges, but then a lot of kids are just, the thing that may bring them to therapy initially is not what keeps them going. And so.
But you're saying, like, is there a boost in their, like, I guess, I don't know, like maturity, right? Like because of their lifestyles, basically. Like they're living a certain kind of life,
right,
and it excels them into going opening that second canister, yeah, because of the way they are experiencing life.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I dig that.
Yeah.
Do you mean, say more? Like, just the way you look at me sometimes.
Say more. I'm very emotive. I can't hide the emotions.
Like, I love this idea of like wisdom isn't set to an age. I mean, I've sat with 12-year-old kids that are more enlightened than 60-year-olds,
yeah,
you know? And so, like, where and how does wisdom and knowledge of self and identity and worldview show up? I think a lot of it depends on that person's life holistically and yeah, what they've been through and what they've seen.
Yeah.
And it's the idea. It's what David said. Man, if you're sitting with a kid and you don't think you have anything to learn from them, get the fuck out of youth work. I want nothing to do with you.
Wow.
You are, this is a privilege. You are
and
learning.
And you get excited. Like there's an, yes, excitement about
they
it.
They have something to
keeping
teach
you fresh, all that. Oh, man, yeah.
Dude, these young people changed my life. I don't know who I'd be without them, man. Like, and that's where I look at Father Gregory Bohl, who runs Homeboy Industries.
Yeah.
And he's written some beautiful books. And he's like, you know, a lot of his volunteers will show up and say, I want to do this work. How can I get in and do this work? And he'll ask them, what do you have to offer to this work? And they'll list all this stuff. And what he's really looking for is them being able to say, I don't know what I bring to this, but I know it's a privilege. And here's what I can gain from it. Here's what it's going to gift me with. Yeah. Every single person at my center, we're getting gifts all day long from walking this sacred journey with these young people that I just feel grateful to be a part of their life.
Yeah.
And they can teach us in so many ways. But that's usually not the lens of how it gets looked at,
right,
you know? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, man.
Yeah. No,
absolutely. Totally. You know, it's funny because, you know, when you were kind of like asking that question, do you think it's like this? I was like, man, Wes, you like see, you're such a wide lens. You know what I mean? So it's like to tie him down.
Is that a fat joke?
No, fat but joke. We do notice you're wearing black right now, and we get it. But
well, I'm a wide lens, but the lens they put on the camera is
10 pounds or something like that. But yeah, you are, it's hard to tie that. I know it's a difficult tying him down.
Yeah.
To section anything because you look with everybody's got their unique thing. So do you think it's, well, it depends, man. You know, we got all kinds of kids coming in for all different kinds of reasons. And you got to get to know that kid to see if that's possible, you know.
All I know, man, I've done this for a long time now, what it feels like. And even with opening Eternal Strength, with opening Cosmic Lamb, with working with these business mentors, with doing all this stuff, when I'm in my office with a young person and we start having session, there's times where I know that's exactly where I need to be. God speaks to me and it's like, this is it.
Right.
And those are the moments where I'm just like, the most beautiful and profound stuff happens when you just show up and you allow, and relationship and love. And I don't want to minimize it to that, but like, if you can let go of everything else, agenda, trying to teach, you're going to do this in this session, or you're going to provide this kid with this. It's like, man, the greatest gift I've learned is you just keep showing up. And every single one of those, I do the best when I think about, and this is morbid, but like, if I think about this, that's the last moment I get with that kid. Changes everything. Then you're not worried about life lessons and trying to teach them anything. You're just worried about creating a sacred space where they feel like they can completely be free and let go and open up.
So if that's the case, right, if it kind of boils down to this human to human connection, right, then what has all of the knowledge that you've acquired through all the training and all the, you know, certifications and the counseling and the psycho understanding and all that stuff. What need is that, and how important is that, having, even though you're not showing it or authorizing that, I don't think that's a word, but in the session, how important is that to creating this youth work in environment? And I have a follow-up question to that.
I was going to say it's a brilliant tool to be able to shut people down. That's all I mean. Right. Like, to be able to literally, when people want to say that it's not that, you can go to the links.
Here's my PhD.
I don't mean
no, you wrong. Hold on. I'll tell you why.
First, he keeps his PhD rolled up in his coat.
You're just a guy. I'm right here, guy.
And I just mean from being able to talk and have discourse and dialogue and to understand different lenses. It's empowered me and given me tools. And I will say the PhD changed my life.
Yeah.
Like, whether or not I obtain that certification, that program at the University of West Georgia, Consciousness and Society, Humanistic, Transpersonal, and Critical Psychologies, and this wide range of exploration absolutely changed my worldview, the lens of how I see myself, how I walk through the world. So it shapes so much, but I would say it comes in handy. It comes in handy with being able to talk to people who have a lot of fears and concerns, and to being able to understand things in even more layers. And the biggest gift I got from the PhD is you could hand me any book, any research, any literature, and I don't feel intimidated about reading it, about understanding it, about digesting it, about
getting it, having the capacity to like know what they're talking about, whatever angle it comes from. You're somewhere in the realm of that, specifically in like psychology and you know, that your work, you're solid in that area.
But it's oftentimes silly too, because it's almost like this giant journey that you take to just get back to
be a baby.
Yeah, and to get back to, I do not think you need a PhD to be a radical youth worker.
Right.
I don't think you need a master's in counseling. I don't think you need a bachelor's in psychology.
Yes.
I think you can be a radical youth worker if you can bring your true heart, you can feel like it's a privilege, and you can carve sacred space. Now, I think those credentials can help in varying ways, but
But I dig that. I dig what Christian is saying. It's like, what, you have all this stuff. Where is the application of all this in your work, in your actual work with a teenager, right?
With the youth, it's not with the teens. It's with the system.
That's what I'm thinking.
I'm not trying to change the kids. I'm trying to change the
system. Yeah, yeah. So you get that.
The doctoral degree.
Right. Now you can hear my perspective.
Embedding myself in academia.
Right.
Being able to write, being able to teach, being able to influence, being able to train and supervise clinicians.
Right.
That's how systemic change can get made.
Being able to do your dissertation in something I've never even heard of in my whole life of dissertations.
Right.
What is that? What is that kind of dissertation?
He had to explain his,
he told me that. I was like, what is that? What is that? They make those? Where do you get those?
But listen, I want to read you guys real quick. It'll take me 2 seconds. But that's where it's interesting, where it's like, who are we trying to change? Are we trying to change the kids? Are we trying to help the kids because the kids are broken and the kids need help? Why are they and what are we trying to do? And so something that Hans wrote, All right, here we go. He says, our backs are turned and our attention is not on the system that is brutally appropriating young people to its ever-increasing appetites. Instead, we are focused on what is wrong with the young people. Why are they so unhappy, alienated, anxious, depressed, suicidal, prone to drug use, gang affiliation, homicidal? It is a nasty bit of smoke and mirrors, a magician's sleight of hand that keeps us thinking that it is the kids that need fixing. Why are the kids struggling, man? They're struggling because our system is fucked up. We are unhealthy.
Yeah.
And so I think their symptoms are a way for us to wake up and make positive political change together.
Man,
mutual liberation.
Right. Listen, if they're suffering, just look in the mirror. You have to look in the mirror and be accountable to that.
Absolutely. Dude.
You know what I'm saying? Like, what are we doing for these? It's nothing that's originating from their being.
Yep.
It's coming from something.
Yep.
It's like we're looking at our reflection, man.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? This is, you have a troubled child that like is always thinking about like killing himself or always feeling hopeless and sad daily. They can't get out of bed. A kid? You know what I'm saying? What's wrong with the kid? No, this is what's wrong with us, man.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? What's wrong with our culture to where the youth, like in a mass now, has amassed a bunch of like sad, hurt beings, bro. Yeah.
And it's systemic. And so there's this beautiful fable, and I forget its origins, but it's somebody walking down a stream. And it's a villager, and they see a baby floating in the stream, and they jump in, they grab the baby, and they pull it out and bring it to dry land. Then they walk a little bit further, and they see two babies. They jump in, and they grab them, and they pull them to dry land. Walk a little bit further, and they see like three, four, jump in, grab them. And at some point, that villager has to decide, do I continue to walk downstream and pull these babies out of the stream, or do I walk up the fucking stream to see why so many babies are getting into the stream?
That's what moved me from private practice. I love that.
Wow.
To build a center.
Yeah.
Was like, yo, man, I can't do this anymore. I could sit here and work one-on-one, which I love and is beautiful, or I can start to build an army. And I can train and I can supervise and we can do radical youth work on a large level and young people can help other young people and they can have voice. Because it's most powerful when you see other young people put their arm around other young people and help.
Oh, that's huge, dude.
I can say shit all day long and I'm 40 and they're like, great, man. You know, and then you see another 16-year-old
dude, that's dope.
Say,
that's
hey,
deep.
Man, I've had two suicidal attempts and you don't need to do this. And there's a beauty in you that you can't see. And it's that thing that you want from your peers at that time. And so how do we foster that and build more of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And right. It's Eternal Strength of Apes. Call one.
So that brings me to the next follow-up question, which is, can this approach be used for anyone, right? Like, or does it only work with youth? Because I think of, you know, my own work with other addicts and alcoholics, right? And I'm beginning to kind of not see that as work with addicts and alcoholics. I'm beginning to see that as just being with another person, right? That's the way I'm starting
to see it. That's a stigma-ending attitude.
Yeah, I'm just starting to see it as like, you know, the process and the system. And then we're not even getting into all the other things that are in here, but there's the whole pathologizing, which I don't know if that's a word, but
yeah.
Where we take it and we go, oh, here are your symptoms, then this is what we're going to do. We're going to run you through this mill, and then the success rates are very low, but that's just what the insurance will pay for, so that's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Right? So, but this radical youth work sounds to me like, oh, man, this could be helpful to me and my current stake, right? Because in a lot of ways, I'm still freaking 14, but, you know, could you see that, like, thinking of a radical system shift in a, and kind of breaking this thing open, could this approach be used for anyone? Or do you think it's really only works with youth because of certain things?
No, I think it absolutely could. And I think you can take the term youth and let age dissipate from it.
Radical work.
Yep. And or no, you could just, youth could meaning, be something. We're youth.
Yeah.
If we tune into the right frequency,
yeah.
It's not something that
because youth, no age.
A certain age,
yeah,
that we're not youth. Youth would be a creative life force. And so how do you do radical youth work with anyone? I think you absolutely can. As long as those principles and those tenets are in it, which is a flattening of a hierarchy, walking hand in hand with another human being, tuning into mutual liberation, common political purpose. Through our relationship, we're freeing one another and working towards similar goals of empowerment and growth. And I think you're doing that with individuals that have struggled with addiction. And then when you really pull back from all of it, and you think about the people who have been in your life that have brought healing to you, it could be anybody.
Right.
Doesn't mm-hmm. have to be a therapist or a yeah. clinician.
An old guy with a pipe, like, telling you about the way life was yeah. in the good old days.
It could be the homeless yeah. guy at the gas station mm-hmm. dropping knowledge.
Who said something to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's I once
shout met, out to the
I,
homeless guy.
I once met, I met with this homeless guy at what's that place? Varsity downtown.
Yeah.
And
hot dogs.
We had a burger together. We were talking, and he turns to me in the middle of the conversation, and he goes, "You're a barbarian." And I was like, "What?" And then he just kind of moved on. Then I went and looked up, well, what's that mean? Because I didn't take it as this is a crazy person.
Yeah.
I looked at it as like, why did he say that? Right.
Yeah.
And started inquiring. And then I saw that the barbarians were the ones that fought off the Catholics from getting into certain areas. And so the Catholic, and this is talking about old ancient Catholic kind of when Catholicism was the political system.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
They fought them off. So then what they ended up doing was creating a different kind of Christianity in their culture because they started experiencing Christ through their own culture and customs.
Were you talking to them about God?
I don't even know if I was.
Okay.
I don't but even know still, if I was.
It was
a profound experience I had from one person who would easily could say this guy was crazy.
Yeah.
Right. And then also that what you described when you described all those components, right, is in its ideal the 12-step fellowship, right? It's peer-to-peer. It's person-to-person. We have a common goal. There's no hierarchy. It's yep. the concept of anonymity. The yep. concept of anonymity is don't nobody know who I am. Mm-hmm. The concept of anonymity is that I sit in this chair, whether I have $1 million.
Right, no matter who I am.
No matter who I am, yeah. I am no less or greater than you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In this arena, in this seat, I don't sit in this seat as Christian, the whatever, I am yeah. just me, right?
Absolutely.
And so in its ideal, that I think that's what the, I guess, culture, community that the 12 steps is, was in certain environments and certain groups are like that, right? Not Absolutely. Every yeah. single meeting place is like that. But
no, at some meetings you get to tell them, I am a barbarian. Don't ever forget that. A wise man once told me.
Yeah. There were other things that I really want, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to, you know, sometime soon have you come back to talk about some of these other things.
Yeah.
Because I think
we're know, not close, are we? I mean, we're
getting rocking. Close.
Are you for real, dude?
Yeah.
No, but there was man. A, I'm not with that.
There That's was not.
No.
I really wanted to talk about this deeper, in depth about this, the DSM and the APA.
Yeah.
Right? Those two diagnostic models.
Oh, your tone. Your tone. You see, it's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about it? It's been updated.
We touched. We touched a little bit on about the mental health industry, but I'd like to talk more about that and eventually. And then this role of mental health in social media and subcultures, identity development, and adolescence, which we talked a little bit about last week's episode. We talked a little bit about that and kind of like the gift of more people being aware of mental
wellness. Pop psychology, things of that nature.
Yes. But at the downside of this awareness of mental wellness is that everybody wants a diagnosis, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And that probably, we could probably dive into those things.
Part two?
Is there feel like, you know, as we're talking about youth work and the stuff that you're doing, is there anything you feel like was missing that's left unsaid?
I mean, the stuff that you just brought up, I have a lot to say, and I just think it's so polarized. Everything is so at odds with one another that I just think we need to take a lot more time with it and not rush it and have in-depth discourse and dialogue, because these are topics that, like, you can't just get through in 2 seconds, and you're really minimizing the complexity of it by just trying to talk about it like really succinctly. So all that stuff that you just brought up made my mind think in all these different ways. But yeah, sorry.
No, go ahead, keep going, man.
No, to your point, like, just how important youth are. Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing to convey is, like, even as I sit here speaking about youth, the best thing ever would be to allow youth to have their own voice. So I even feel pretentious talking about youth.
You feel kind of like,
let me tell you about the youth that we you know what I mean? But it's these are beautiful human spirits and human souls on their journey of growth and this radical pilgrimage. And it's just like, they got so much to teach us. They got so much to teach us. And yes, we simultaneously can teach them, but I think letting those lines blur a little bit and not seeing it as a us and them, and seeing it as
together.
Yes.
Ram Dass says, we're really just walking each other home.
Boom.
Oh, I love that, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all we're really doing. And the other thing that keeps popping up is the verse that unless you become like these little ones, you shall not inherit the kingdom of earth, the kingdom of heaven.
Amen.
Absolutely.
You won't inherit it.
Yeah.
Because there's something that these kids got that you don't got.
Absolutely.
You you lose it.
Yep. You lose it. We lose it. And I've lost it. And at times I lose it.
Speak for yourselves.
But I think it is. It's kind of like that's the...
There's something so backwards about it, bro. Like, there's something, like, we see it as, like, you know, I guess growing and, like, we call maturing. I think it's such a backward... It's like a dissipating process to me, because when you are like freaking innocent and you have like joy, you know, and it doesn't have to, like, you know, it doesn't have to, like, you know, find funny or find joy in like these real intricate things. It's just like, you know, it's more real that way. The older you get, man, it's just, it fades, man.
It's hard.
And that scripture really details that, like, yo, unless you have the innocence of this baby here, that born again, if you can't experience that born again feeling.
Right. Dude, well, that's even getting to whatever born again means, right?
Yeah.
Because there's probably a reason why they use those terms,
right? Yeah.
To be born again. And in my own growth and journey, that's my deepest desire now, is I want to return to that. Whatever that feeling I have when I'm in the ocean in California and the waves are throwing me around like a little fucking bitch. Whatever that feeling is, I want to live in that, right? I want to live in that kind of like, whoa, because that's how it feels when I'm in the ocean. And there's part of me that feels like that's attainable.
Yeah.
Something in me knows that maybe I can't always be there, but I certainly could be spending more time in that state of being than I do.
Yeah.
You know where I think would be the most obtainable is when you're with that crowd.
Yeah.
And you're not looking down, you're with them.
Yeah.
And that when you hear that joy, it's just going to spread to you, like,
right, which is what you're talking about when you're working with them, or when
it all comes back.
The bonfire and you see those kids just rocking out and
the best part of my day today, man, and I had beautiful moments, but I had to do a ton of meetings, different Zooms, online stuff, and then I was leaving, and I had two Zoom sessions, one at 2:30 and one at 3:30, and they were cool. One was with some parents, and another was with an older client, and I got out to my car, and both of them needed to cancel. And I got to go back into the center for a little bit and hang out with Mike and Ty at the front desk area. And Mike's client came in, younger girl, she's like 16. And then younger dude was just getting out of session with Ashley, and he's like 22. And so for a moment there, it was Ashley, Mike, Ty, I, and two younger people that come up to the center. And we just started talking about everything.
Yeah.
And it went from Mike Tyson to like shark attacks to like what, but an hour, and we were all in flow state, laughing, joking, and yeah, in the present moment, and it was beautiful. Yeah. And I think that's childlike wonder.
Yeah.
And I think Jason Silva, he talks about that brilliant. If you look up a little video that he does, and he says, we all have that capacity. And we're all artists. We're born artists, and we're born in that space, and we're in the present moment, and we experience all that. And then, yeah, as we get older, it becomes the been there, done that's. And
yeah,
we don't see it as special, and we just start to get overwhelmed. And I don't think it's impossible, but I think you got to make more time for it. You got to carve it more. And I don't
got to embrace it instead of looking. You can't. You got to embrace it instead of looking at it like it's ignorance.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, they're just right. Kids. They don't know. Yeah. No, dude. Like honestly, like that's what when you're 80, you always said, I wish I woulda.
Yeah.
You know what absolutely. I mean? If I would have just.
Yeah.
Because so much of his life was living in this constraint of being like this adult being and the responsibilities and getting lost in the responsibilities of that, that the joy just, you think it's like, it's supposed to be, we're raised to like, the joy is supposed to be sucked out of you once you create another life, right?
And you can do both, and you can do both really well. You can be really structured and responsible and mature and balanced and strategic, and you can also have a beautiful amount of artistic childlike wonder and presence. It doesn't have to be either or.
Yeah.
A lot of people feel like it's got to be like, well, now I put my pants on this way and I do this and I schedule joy and it only happens Friday night at this time. And it is.
And you instill that attitude in your child as soon as like, as soon as they're almost upright, you're like, all right, how much money are you going to save? What are you going to do?
Well, and then that goes in because it's the whole thing. And then little Johnny does a dance and the whole, all the parents clap and little Johnny thinks, oh, that's how I get these giants, to pay attention.
Love.
Yeah.
Acceptance. Oh man, that makes me feel like a bad parent.
I feel like that all the time.
Cause I'm always like, you did it.
Yeah. So I want to encourage, if anyone's made it this far on the app, there is a thing in the education section that Wes and Kara came and did a parent empowerment webinar. And I share that with everybody who reaches out to me to work with their young person. It's the parents. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I always try to minister to the parents first, right? Because that's who's reaching out.
Yeah.
And I send them this. Because what the two of you guys talked about there, you touched on a little bit tonight, but it's about, you really get into that. So I want to encourage anyone who has a young person in their life that they want the best for is to check that out.